Chapter 44. That, constitutionally indisposed as he was to stand and watch, he became as glued to the spot as the other idlers. Finding himself now for the first time directly confronting the preliminaries of Ethelberta's marriage to a stranger, he was left with far less equanimity than he could have supposed possible to the situation. So near the time. ... he said, and looked hard at Lord Mountclere. Christopher had now a far better opportunity than before for observing Ethelberta's betrothed. Apart from any bias of jealousy, disappointment, or mortification, he was led to judge that this was not quite the man to make Ethelberta happy. He had fancied her companion to be a man under 50, he was now visibly 60 or more. And it was not the sort of sexagenarianism beside which a young woman's happiness can sometimes contrive to keep itself alive in a quiet, sleepy way. Suddenly it occurred to him that this was the man whom he had helped in the carriage accident on the way to Nulcia. He looked again. By no means undignified, the face presented that combination of slyness and jocundity which we are accustomed to imagine of the canonical jolly dogs in medieval tales. The gamesome curate of Muden might have supplied some parts of the countenance, cunning Friar Tuck the remainder. Nothing but the Viscount's constant habit of going to church every Sunday morning, when at his country residence, kept unholiness out of his features. For though he lived theologically enough on the Sabbath, as it became a man in his position to do, he was strikingly mundane all the rest of the week, always preferring the devil to God in his oaths. And nothing but antecedent good humor prevented the short fits of crossness incident to his passing infirmities from becoming established. His look was exceptionally jovial now, and the corners of his mouth twitched as the telegraph needles of 100 little erotic messages from his heart to his brain. Anybody could see that he was a merry man still, who loved good company, warming drinks, nymph-like shapes, and pretty words, in spite of the disagreeable suggestions he received from the pupils of his eyes, and the joints of his lively limbs, that imps of mischief were busy sapping and mining in those regions, with the view of tumbling him into a certain cool cellar under the church aisle. In general, if a lover can find any ground at all for serenity in the tide of an elderly rival's success, he finds it in the fact itself of that ancientness. The other side seems less a rival than a makeshift. But Christopher no longer felt this, and the significant signs before his eyes of the imminence of Ethelberta's union with this old hero filled him with restless dread. True, the gentleman, as he appeared illuminated by the jeweler's gas jets, seemed more likely to injure Ethelberta by indulgence than by severity, while her beauty lasted. But there was a nameless something in him less tolerable than this. The purchaser, having completed his dealings with the goldsmith, was conducted to the door by the master of the shop, and into the carriage, which was at once driven off up the street. Christopher now much desired to know the name of the man whom a nice chain of circumstantial evidence taught him to regard as the happy winner where scores had lost. He was grieved that Ethelberta's confessed reserve should have extended so far as to limit her to mere indefinite hints of marriage when they were talking almost on the brink of the wedding day. That the ceremony was to be a private one, which it probably would be because of the disparity of ages, did not in his opinion justify her secrecy. He had shown himself capable of a transmutation as valuable as it is rare in men, the change from pestering lover to staunch friend, and this was all he had got for it. But even an old lover sunk to an indifferentist might have been tempted to spend an unoccupied half hour in discovering particulars now, and Christopher had not lapsed nearly so far as to absolute unconcern. That evening, however, nothing came in his way to enlighten him. But the next day, when skirting the close on his ordinary duties, he saw the same carriage standing at a distance, and paused to behold the same old gentleman come from a well-known office and re-enter the vehicle Lord Mountclair, in fact, in earnest pursuit of the business of yesternight, having just pocketed a document in which romance, rashness, law, and gospel are so happily made to work together that it may safely be regarded as the neatest compromise which has ever been invented since Adam sinned. This time Julian perceived that the brougham was one belonging to the White Hart Hotel, which Lord Mountclair was using partly from the necessities of these hasty proceedings, and also because, by so doing, he escaped the notice that might have been bestowed upon his own equipage, or men servants, the Mountclair hammer cloths being known in Melchester. Christopher now walked towards the hotel, leisurely, yet with anxiety. He inquired of a porter what people were staying there that day, and was informed that they had only one person in the house, Lord Mountclair, whom sudden and unexpected business had detained in Melchester since the previous day. Christopher lingered to hear no more. He retraced the street much more quickly than he had come, and he only said, "Lord Mountclair, it must never be." As soon as he entered the house, Faith perceived that he was greatly agitated. He at once told her of his discovery, and she exclaimed, "What a brilliant match!" Said Christopher, "you don't know. You are far from knowing. It is as gloomy as midnight. Good God, can it be possible?" Faith blinked in alarm, without speaking. "Did you never hear anything of Lord Mountclair, when we lived at Sandburn?" "I knew the name no more." "No, of course you did not. Well, though I never saw his face, to my knowledge, till a short time ago, I know enough to say that, if earnest representations can prevent it, this marriage shall not be. Father knew him, or about him, very well, and he once told me, what I cannot tell you. Fancy, I have seen him 3 times yesterday, last night, and this morning besides helping him on the road some weeks ago, and never once considered that he might be Lord Mountclair. He is here almost in disguise, one may say, neither man nor horse is with him, and his object accounts for his privacy. I see how it is she is doing this to benefit her brothers and sisters, if possible, but she ought to know that, if she is miserable they will never be happy. That's the nature of women, they take the form for the essence, and that's what she is doing now. I should think her guardian angel must have quitted her, when she agreed to a marriage which may tear her heart out like a claw. You are too warm about it. Kid, it cannot be so bad as that. It is not the thing, but the sensitiveness to the thing, which is the true measure of its pain. Perhaps what seems so bad to you falls lightly on her mind. A campaigner in a heavy rain is not more uncomfortable than we are in a slight draft, and Ethelberta, fortified by her sapphires and gold cups and wax candles, will not mind facts which look like specters to us outside. A title will turn troubles into romances, and she will shine as an interesting viscountess in spite of them. The discussion with Faith was not continued, Christopher stopping the argument by saying that he had a good mind to go off at once to Nulcia and show her her danger. But till the next morning Ethelberta was certainly safe. No marriage was possible anywhere before then. He passed the afternoon in a state of great indecision, constantly reiterating, "I will go." 41. Workshops and in the street on an extensive plot of ground, lying somewhere between the Thames and the Kensington Squares, stood the premises of Messrs. Knockett and Perch, builders and contractors. The yard with its workshops formed part of one of those frontier lines between mangy business and garnished domesticity that occur in what are called improving neighborhoods. We are accustomed to regard ingress as the chief feature in a great city's progress, its well-known signs greeting our eyes on every outskirt. Slush ponds may be seen turning into basement kitchens. A broad causeway of shattered earthenware smothers plots of budding gooseberry bushes and vegetable trenches, foundations following so closely upon gardens that the householder may be expected to find cadaverous sprouts from overlooked potatoes rising through the chinks of his cellar floor. But the other great process, that of internal transmutation, is not less curious than this encroachment of gray upon green. Its first erections are often only the milk teeth of a suburb, and as the district rises in dignity they are dislodged by those which are to endure. Slightness becomes supplanted by comparative solidity, commonness by novelty, lowness, and irregularity by symmetry and height. An observer of the precinct which has been named as an instance in point might have stood under a lamp post and heard simultaneously the peal of the visitor's bell from the new terrace on the right hand, and the stroke of tools from the moldy workshops on the left. Wagons laden with deals came up on this side, and landers came down on the other, the former, to lumber heavily through the old established contractor's gates, the latter to sweep fashionably into the square. About 12 o'clock on the day following Lord Mountclere's exhibition of himself to Christopher in the jeweler's shop at Melchester, and almost at the identical time when the Viscount was seen to come from the office for marriage licenses in the same place, a carriage drove nearly up to the gates of Messrs. Knockett and Company apostrophe's yard. A gentleman stepped out and looked around. He was a man whose ears would have been pronounced as 5 and 40 by the friendly, 50 by the candid, 52 or 53 by the grim. He was as handsome a study in gray as could be seen in town, there being far more of the raven's plumage than of the gull's in the mixture as yet, and he had a glance of that practiced sort which can measure people, weigh them, repress them, encourage them to sprout and blossom as a March sun encourages crocuses, ask them questions, give them answers, in short, a glance that could do as many things as an American cooking stove or a multum in parvo pocket knife. But, as with most men of the world, this was mere mechanism. His actual emotions were kept so far within his person that they were rarely heard or seen near his features. On reading the builder's names over the gateway, he entered the yard and asked at the office if Solomon Chickerell was engaged on the premises. The clerk was going to be very attentive, but finding the visitor had come only to speak to a workman, his tense attitude slackened a little, and he merely signified the foot of a Flemish ladder on the other side of the yard, saying, "You will find him, sir, up there in the joiner's shop." When the man in the black coat reached the top, he found himself at the end of a long apartment as large as a chapel, and as low as a malt room, across which ran parallel carpenter's benches to the number of 20 or more, a gangway being left at the side for access throughout. Behind every bench there stood a man or two, planing, fitting, or chiseling, as the case might be. The visitor paused for a moment, as if waiting for some cessation of their violent motions and uproar till he could make his errand known. He waited 10 seconds, he waited 20, but, beyond that, a quick look had been thrown upon him by every pair of eyes, the muscular performances were in no way interrupted. Everyone seemed oblivious of his presence, and absolutely regardless of his wish. In truth, the texture of that salmon-colored skin could be seen to be aristocratic without a microscope, and the exceptious artisan has an offhand way, when contrasts are made painfully strong by an idler of this kind coming, gloved and brushed, into the very den, where he is sweating and muddling in his shirt sleeves. The gentleman from the carriage then proceeded down the workshop, wading up to his knees in a sea of shavings, and bruising his ankles against corners of board and sawn-off blocks that lay hidden like reefs beneath. At the 9th bench he made another venture. "Sol Chickerell?" said the man addressed, as he touched his plain iron upon the oilstone. "He's one of them just behind." "Damn it all, can't one of you show me?" The visitor angrily observed, for he had been used to more attention than this. Here, point him out. Apostrophe apostrophe he handed the man a shilling. No trouble to do that, apostrophe said the workman, and he turned and signified Sol by a nod without moving from his place. The stranger entered Sol's division, and, nailing him with his eye, said at once, I want to speak a few words with you in private. Is not a Mrs. Peterwin your sister? Apostrophe apostrophe, Sol started suspiciously. Has anything happened to her? Apostrophe he at length said hurriedly. Oh no. It is on a business matter that I have called. You need not mind owning the relationship to me, the secret will be kept. I am the brother of one whom you may have heard of from her Lord Mountclear. Apostrophe apostrophe, I have not. But if you will wait a minute, sir apostrophe he went to a little glazed box at the end of the shop, where the foreman was sitting, and, after speaking a few words to this person, Sol led Mountclear to the door, and down the ladder. I suppose we cannot very well talk here after all? Apostrophe apostrophe said the gentleman, when they reached the yard, and found several men moving about there. Perhaps we had better go to some room the nearest in will answer the purpose, won't it? Apostrophe apostrophe, excellently. Apostrophe apostrophe, there's the green bushes over the way. They have a very nice private room upstairs. Apostrophe apostrophe, yes, that will do. Apostrophe apostrophe and passing out of the yard, the man with the glance, entered the inn with Sol, where they were shown to the parlor as requested. While the waiter was gone for some wine, which Mountclear ordered, the more ingenuous of the two resumed the conversation by saying, awkwardly, Yes, Mrs. Peterwin is my sister, as you supposed, sir, but on her account I do not let it be known. Apostrophe apostrophe, indeed, apostrophe said Mountclear. Well, I came to see you in order to speak of a matter which I thought you might know more about than I do, for it has taken me quite by surprise. My brother, Lord Mountclear, is, it seems, to be privately married to Mrs. Peterwin tomorrow. Apostrophe apostrophe, is that really the fact? Apostrophe apostrophe said Sol, becoming quite shaken. I had no thought that such a thing could be possible. Apostrophe apostrophe, it is imminent. Apostrophe apostrophe, father has told me that as he has lately got to know some nobleman, but I never supposed there could be any meaning in that. Apostrophe apostrophe, you were altogether wrong, apostrophe said Mountclear, leaning back in his chair and looking at Sol steadily. Do you feel it to be a matter upon which you will congratulate her? Apostrophe apostrophe, a very different thing. Apostrophe apostrophe said Sol vehemently. Though he is your brother, sir, I must say this, that I would rather she married the poorest man I know. Apostrophe apostrophe, why? Apostrophe apostrophe, from what my father has told me of him, he is not a more desirable brother-in-law to me than I shall be in all likelihood to him. What? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.